Hi, and welcome to Reasonable and Necessary, a Steady's premier podcast series on everything that ever wanted to know about the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. I'm your host, Dr. George Talaforis, and on today's episode, we've got Kate Fernley, who was recently appointed to chair the National Disability Insurance Agencies. We'll talk to him about why he took on the role and what he hopes to achieve for people with disabilities, and much more. Check it out. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the show.
G'day, Dr. George. Thanks for having me.
Oh, mate, you have the most important role on the most important scheme. That is the NDIS, mate. Woo! How's it feel?
I'm going to sound like a politician straight away and just say that every role within the NDIA is the most important role within the NDIA. We need to make sure that wherever you are within the organisation, the understanding that what work you do is just pivotally important in the way somebody lives their life. And whether you are the chair of the board, on the board, whether you're part of the executive, whether you are back of house with the efficiencies in processing claims, or whether you are a planner, or whether you wherever you are in that process of somebody allowing them to have structures to live their life, you are extraordinarily important. I know that's a bit of a cop-out, because on the other side of that conversation, I am both equally excited and nervous and all the emotions in between. But, mate, I love this scheme. I've loved it since I first started talking about it back in 2012, and to begin the role to chair this board. And I do note that it is going to be an extremely collaborative board. It's exciting to join it with Graham Innes, with Marianne Diamond, and of course the reappointment of Dennis Napthine as well to the existing board. I would be lying if I didn't acknowledge there's a certain amount of nerves and anxiety as well.
Well, yes, I'm glad you did say that about everyone being really important in the NDIS. And, I think the planners and the frontline people are probably more important than you, Kate. Don't take offense to that, but it's really the people who are working directly with the people that we need to make sure that they deliver the promise that was the NDIS, and at the same time, your role is very important and very exciting as well.
So to follow that up, I would say as a young fellow, when you're going through the block funded system where you were finding supports, I didn't know what was behind the governance or what was behind the system. I knew the person that was in front of me, and that person either made me feel like I had a potential to live a great life, or I felt like I was a burden, and I felt like I was something that was getting in the road of doing their job. So that's why it is, it's the immediate response for me is that the important people in the scheme are the people that I face to face. They're the cold face of what will make this scheme extraordinary.
Now, you're the chair. Let's explain to people, what does the chair of the NDIS do? We had Bruce Bonahady, and we all got used to seeing him. And what do you, what's the role going to look like with you in charge?
Bruce was one of the first people that I called when the possibility of taking on this role crossed my desk. I I see the chair of this organ of the NDIA not only it facilitates meetings, board meetings, of course. It sets out with the board a collaborative conversation with the board and the executive about the strategic direction of the organisation. So the chair of the board may not be able to turn, it's not like turning a Ferrari or something like that. It's more about the changes that can be made long term when it comes to the overall direction of the organization. It also, I see the role also like Bruce did, that it is pivotal in stakeholder engagement as well, to ensure that the voice of the community are held, heard at the board level. And that's why the last week I've been calling stakeholders, and I've been calling leaders within the community, and I've been calling people who were a part of the lobbying and a part of the conversation to create this scheme as well. So
I can vouch for that, Kevin. I got a text message from you that I did it not. I'm like, oh, it's Camp Family. and I'll see what. And when I ran it, you said to me, so, George, what do we need to do for the NDIS? And I was like, nice. It's 8:30 at night. I had a long day. Can we have this conversation in a reasonable hour? But. Good on you for asking.
Mate, I haven't started the job yet, so I'm not. There's the acting chair or the chair of Jim Minto is still in the role. But I truly want to make sure that it's understood that this is an opportunity to have. This is an opportunity to have the voice of people with disabilities well and truly heard in this role. If nothing more, if I do nothing more over the period of time that I am in this role, it is about building a trusted relationship with the community, and that starts from being heard. So that's why this week it hasn't been about talking to the media, because I don't feel like this is. There's a lot of this that isn't about me. Right, like this is about making sure that we have a board that through the chair has a connection to community.
Indeed. And I think that we realised, through the whole independent assessments situation, that really listening to people is what's going to make the NDIS work. And I'm very excited that you've got. Listening as your number one priority. I want to ask you about your relationship with the NDIS, and you were on the IOC, the Independent Advisory Council, but you're not a participant, is that right?
I'm not, and it was the first question that I was asked, and I used to have, Stella Young used to rip into me every time that she saw me, and she would ask me, are you on it yet? Are you on it yet? Are you on it yet? And we used to have discussions, and there was an idea for a period of time that I wanted to make sure that I could advocate for the scheme from outside, from a truly independent position, that I was in this privileged position through sport to have a direct contact to community that were providing me with what was reasonable and necessary to live a good life. Like I had this amazing inbuilt tier two, right? like a sports provider that I had a direct contact in that would give me a wheelchair that allowed me access. I had a partner, a family that offered informal supports for me to be able to continue to engage in the community as I was. I regret it now that I'm not. But
can I stop you there, Kurt? Why do you regret it? For me, I heard you. I was watching an interview just before which it was when it got announced and you're with Bill Shorten and Marianne Diamond, and you said that you regret not being on the screen. Why would you regret not being, you know,
have I regret
to depend on the government? Like, no one wants that.
No, it's more I regret that people that the community who rely on Scheme deserve to see a chair that is with them on that scheme. I hope to see a chair going forward that isn't just a person with a disability, but somebody who has had the experience of engaging with the scheme as a participant. Nothing more or less than that. It isn't a I have no idea whether I will become a participant of the scheme. My experience with disability has changed as I have got older, and my experience with community has changed as well. And like, we know that disability needs are not stagnant; they change with life that is around you. You know, your ability to have choice and control, your ability to assess what is fair and reasonable, to live a good life, and your idea of what a good life is changes depending on where you are on that timeline. So at some point I may, but the reason why I say I regret it is purely because I personally love that there is a person with a disability as chair. I really do, but I do look forward to the day that there is a participant of the scheme who is also in this role, because that lived experience then will get taken to another level.
I can say that. Thank you for clarifying that. Now, I know that you have also had other roles in the sector and governance roles. So, can you tell us a bit about those and how you think they're going to help you in your current role?
Yeah.
And don't worry, this isn't a job interview. You've already got the job, mate.
I had to go through my work over the last 20 years to actually convince myself to take the role, to tell you the truth, George, because I think that I've always had a healthy dose of skepticism. I've jumped into some pretty wild stuff, but I've always had a bit of skepticism, and I've always had to methodically go through the reasons why I believe I can be the right person at that period of time. I had the good fortune to be given an opportunity when I was immediately out of university. I was studying, I finished and graduated as a high school teacher, and I worked with an organisation that it was a wonderful organisation. It was a non-government NGO working in the foreign aid space. It was spending volunteers abroad, and I was invited to join the board immediately out of uni, and they were starting to develop programs that would operate in the disability space. And Bob Mine, his name is, he was the head of my faculty at university. He was the chair of the board, and he didn't want to go into that space until he had representation on the board. And what I, you know, that's 2005. He's already thinking that there is risk at a board level by not having the lived experience there. He recognised that you can have lawyers and accountants and you can have people who have worked in the sector, but if you don't have the voice of people who are living in the area that we are operating, that creates a layer of risk that is pretty hard to fill. So he invited me on, and I joined as an observer for the first 6 months because I wanted to convince myself that I had value at that level. And I joined and got a crash course on the fiduciary responsibilities of a director. From there, I fell in love with the role that a director can play, because it's like you are the, it's like you get to, what's the, it's like you get to guide an organization or guide an agency through what can be some pretty troubled waters. And you were able to create a lot of good from that role. And we saw hundreds of Australians going overseas creating, you know, amazing programs. And from there, I decided to continue that work, and I joined as many advisory groups, as many boards that I possibly could. I was voted in the Athlete Council to bring the athlete voice of the Paralympic movement, which is a proud movement for people with disabilities. But that athlete voice at the top level of the IPC, to be a part of that as vice chair, was incredible. To join the board of Sport Australia to help facilitate the government support through Commonwealth Games, Olympic Games and Paralympic Games. I joined the board of Life Without Barriers because I felt like it was a part of my life that I would regret having worked abroad with disability. I wanted to see the other side of service provision and to see the people behind that industry.
Can I ask about Life Without Barriers? Because I'm really, I'm also on a board of director for a disability provider, and the worst nightmare for any board of director is, someone in the service being abused or in some way not given the best service. What did you learn from the whole Royal Commission experience and everything that happened there?
I completely agree with you that I don't know any person that reads that follows along the stories of abuse, neglect, and any sort of harm that would come somebody that is within a client or a customer of or a participant of any sort of scheme that you're associated with. It's the stuff that keeps you up at night. I learnt that there is a lot that is felt when you are in one of those roles, and you need to have a lot of trust in the organization that you are a part of as well, and a good working relationship with the CEO. The reason why I joined LWB in particular is that it works in so many different aspects of this country, and it works in some of the most challenging parts of the sector. We know that disability is complicated, right? Like, it is complicated, and the services that provide people with disabilities access into life is bloody diverse. And when it goes well, it's great. When it goes bad, it hurts. And it hurts every person in every layer of every organization that I've worked with. That's my learning, is that you feel it. There is no way to escape it. It hurts. And anyone that's following, though, I would say, George, all of the stories that come out of the Disability Royal Commission, every person should hear it. Every person should feel it. We need community to feel it, or else we're not going to get change. So, just yesterday, mate, you heard the stories that came out about abuse directed directly towards people with disabilities on the streets, and we need to confront these stories, and we need to learn from them, and we need to be better because of it.
We certainly do, Kat, and I think that you being one of our people are going to be someone who's going to be able to really make sure that whatever happens with the NDIS, that we are making sure that people are looked after and safe and get the best services
I can assure you that whatever decisions are coming ahead, that they are going to be felt as well as heard.
I want to maybe, I'm really curious to know what happened in terms of you being that moment when you were asked, like, was it on the phone or were you just hanging out with your mate Bill Shorten? I don't know. Like, was it, how did that happen?
I don't know whether I'm allowed to divulge. Am I allowed to divulge?
Come on. This isn't Secret Service.
it was a conversation. I was actually meeting with Bill on another matter, and I think that I'd worked with Bill for on and off for different periods in different things for a lot of years. I think that if you've been around the disability space since pre the NDIS, Bill did some work on infrastructure and accessible standards. And I did a couple of things for him back then. I think it was 2008, 2009.
Yeah, when he was the parliamentary secretary. I remember when that happened, I was like, finally, someone that actually seems to care.
I actually remember saying something in a meeting with him, and I said, I think I worded it as in, we'll come knocking on Bill's door, and Bill goes, hey, my door is open, and we'll go knocking on the next person, whether it was the Prime Minister's door, it was like, and it was an immediate, oh, wait, like, that's, you're with us there, And I think that was a really refreshing conversation, and that was over 10 years ago. And we've remained in contact, and we did little bits and pieces over that period of time. And he did mention a few times whether if he became the minister for the NDIS, whether or not I'd work with him. And I said, I don't know, there's so much going on and everything like this. And then I was in the room with him, and he asked me, and my immediate response was, I don't process things immediately. I need to go away, and I need to actually make sure that intrinsically I believe I can do something good in that role. And I said no, and then he said, I want you to think about it. And he is a very convincing.
You said no.
My immediate
response. You didn't say anything to think about it. You said no. I'm too busy.
No, it wasn't too busy. I was scared, honestly, for a moment. Uh-huh. I went, and I thought, I wasn't sure whether or not he was offering this job to about 15 different people. So I looked around at the people in the room as well and said, "Is it, what's happening here?" And then I said, I just need to think about it. I need to think about it. And I was in the middle of recording 1+1 on ABC. I was in the middle of recording, I can't tell you the other show that I was recording. It's not announced till next year. I was already on the board of LWB, and they were doing some really exciting work in a couple of fronts that I was cautious about leaving. And I'd only been on there for 11 months at that point in time. I had started a production company with my friend, and we were just starting to produce a lot of content with a couple of other brands. I had just joined the board of Brisbane 2032, the Paralympic and Olympic Games. I'm on the board of Sport Australia. So there was an immediate kind of moment of fear. How am I going to do this? And then there was, I need to go away and see whether or not this is firstly possible. Secondly, whether or not I can do it and leave an impact that I believe is, aligns with who I am. And there was a conversation with my wife, because this job, you know, it is a pretty intense role that has requirements around it, and I couldn't take it without talking to her, and her words were, look, you might regret it if you take it, because it is going to cause it is it will be a lot of stress, but you will definitely regret it if you don't take it, because it aligns so closely with the change that you kind of want to be a part of, and you've spoken about the agency, and it's been a part of your life since before it was a thing. And whenever somebody asks, how will you get through that? And how will you manage everything? She goes, we always manage. Like, it's just, we always manage. No matter what happens, we get through it. We sort it out.
Yeah. So you said no, and then you spoke to your partner and had some time to think about it.
I said, within a couple of minutes, I said, let me think about it. Give me a bit. And then I think I just sent a text message back and said, if you still want me, I'm in.
So what kind of chair can we expect from Kate Freeman?
I think that I hope to be a collaborative chair. Of course, I want to work with the board. I also want to ensure that I am a chair that is listening to community, and we have a wonderful part of the structure of the NDIA that is the Independent Advisory Council, which I loved being a part of for 3 or 4 years. That I know that you're a member of as well, George. That I look forward to engaging with in the so within the organisation itself. I also want to hear from the staff. I want to get to know the staff. I want to listen. I want to listen to the participants, and I think that we also have a minister that is. Passionate about making sure that this scheme is successful and around for many, 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 many generations to come. So I will be collaborative, and not just in a board sense. I want to make sure that the community see themselves in this role.
I mean, I know it's early days, but there are any priorities, like, and I know that you need to talk to the board, and you know, the board needs to work out its priorities, but are there any sort of early ideas that you are willing to, like, I don't know, just...
You're trying to sneak another scoop out of me, George. My sole priority right now is to listen. That is it. I want to listen to the community. I want to get to know the organization again. I'm excited for Rebecca to come in and to Rebecca Falkington to come in as CEO and to get behind this incredible agency in her own way as well, and to get to know how she sees the space going forward. But for the moment, my sole priority is just to listen.
Totally, totally glad to hear that. That is your priority. One of the big things that you've said, and that Bill's been saying, is that we need to rebuild trust. And, you know, listening is a very good starting point. What else do we need to do to rebuild trust, do you think?
I think that ensuring that people with disabilities are seen to be a part of the improvement of the scheme. So it's not just listening; it'll be the steps going forward where there are opportunities to improve, to ensure that the voice of disability is within that, and so that we can ensure that community are coming with us on the journey. I think that's. I know that it's part of your. That it's something that you feel passionate about is co-design, and that is about making sure that, again, it's not just my voice, but it's not just the process of listening, it's ensuring that what is heard is taken into the process going forward. I think that is how we build trust.
I'm very big on listening, and one of the things that I try to do with this podcast is to listen to the community and try and put forward some of the questions and issues. And I went on to the grassroots Facebook page, and I invited members on that group to throw some questions at you, Kat, and there's about 150 raw questions.
Recognizing that the role isn't operational, and that I'm going to put the proviso out there that it's not operational, that the individual circumstances of somebody's plan, I think there are very real limitations on how I can either comment or assist on individuals, on the individual case, because then I think it would actually create a problem going forward. Then that would mean the person who has my mobile number, or the person who's my family member, or the person who lives next door to me has better access to the scheme than what every other participant does, where this role is about, it's about assisting in creating the structures so that every person, every participant has equal access to this scheme. So I'm putting all of those provisos, plus I haven't started, plus I haven't spoken to the board. So I'm putting everything out there, George.
Put it all out there, mate. And how about we just go for the most reactive top three? And this is your instant, like, gut feeling, not your chairperson of the board response, right? Because technically you're not the chair until next week. So you can say whatever you like.
I think we both know that that's not 100% the case, because there are decisions that will be coming ahead that require collaboration with the board, and also the executive need to be allowed the space to create their own space there as well. But that said, I'll do my best.
Look, here we go. So, question number one, Kat. Why are NDIS staff who have no medical qualifications overriding decisions that are made by medical and allied health specialists?
So I lean back into my days in the IAC, where you would talk about, I always had a concern that there would be the potential where medical professions would have too much say over somebody's plan, and then we would go to the medical model of disability, and I think that can create some risk. I think that if I was to have had a plan that would have been designed by a medical professional, then my plan as a kid was, when I went to a medical profession and under the previous system, my plan was defined in front of me, and I was told what the structures should be. And I remember getting a wheelchair that was just, it was impractical, and it actually made my life worse. I remember sitting there and saying to the medical professional that it won't work, and being told that I don't know what I need. So it was meant to be a conversation about an individual, and take more than just the report of a allied health professional, but also the conversations about a person's goals, in my instance, I got the greatest bit of advice from a person with a disability sitting across from me. His name was Michael Callahan. He looked at me, he was as a person with a disability, and he asked me what I wanted out of my equipment, out of my life, and he designed a wheelchair for me that was the very first one that allowed me to actually live. And that wasn't an allied professional, that was a person with a disability. What we would probably say at either the planning phase, who saw more than just the medical report. So in the IAC, back in those early stages, it was recognised that we would get better outcomes if we have planners with lived experience sitting across from a participant who is also a person with a disability, that you would, and in my instance, and again, this is not speaking as a chair, this is back in my day, Dr. George, back in my day, the medical plan would have been more expensive with worse outcomes.
And I'll just add to that, there's the fact that the agency is bound by the NDIS Act, and the Act, you know, talks about reasonable and necessary, and we need to make sure that regardless of what the medical expert says, it also needs to meet the section of the Act that talks about what can get funded. I'm going to take you to another one. This is mine. No, it's not really, but I agree full-heartedly around this one. Why aren't we provided with the opportunity to look over a draft of our plan to ensure that no mistakes or misinformation occurs before the plan gets approved? Good idea, don't you think?
Well, how about that? How about I hate to make commitments before I join the board, but I think I'm definitely committed to working with the agency to improve the participant plan experience. And I think transparency in that process will assist in that conversation around trust. So, well, I make no promises, Dr. George. I haven't been in the role yet. I'm not there yet, but I do look forward, and I will commit to exploring how the process can meet participants' expectations. And I would say over the last couple of weeks, one of those participant expectations has been greater visibility over that.
Yeah, and I think that would be beneficial to the agency as well. Okay, last one. Don't worry, it's nearly over. In circumstances where the participant is happy with their current plan, why can't we just roll it over? So we don't have to go through the stress of a plan review.
Yeah, I do know that. I did speak about earlier about somebody's plan changes as they head through, and their experience with disability changes throughout their life. Over the last, I could be wrong, but throughout COVID, there was an increase in the amount of time that you could roll over your plan.
Yeah.
I would like to say that could be one of the benefits from the experience of COVID, is that there seems to be, and again, I'm not there, the lesson learned that is an efficiency and a way that we can allow also somebody to have the surety over life of what life will look like in 2 years' time, in 3 years' time. The only thing in the back of my head is that somebody's goals change as they age, and the ability to be able to reassess a plan and go forward to ensure that is appropriate still. That is the only kind of what is it called, light bulb that is there. But I think every person with a disability has been in the place where you've had to fill out, are you still in a wheelchair?
I'm still disabled. Wow.
Well, that's the same as what it was when I was born, and it will be the same until I am. It won't be the same. I hope that my goals and that my you know, I hope that it is reassessed. What is reasonable and necessary for me to live a good life is reassessed. But
you know, my thoughts on this question is that, yeah, totally, you know, if you want to roll over, then that should be your option. But I think it's important that we do, you know, check in and see how we're going in terms of achieving the goals and getting the support that we need. But I just, it also reminds me of the fact that if planning was not so scary and people weren't so terrified of having their plans cut, then it would be quite an okay thing to do every couple of years, right?
The plan was always a facilitator of outcomes. So those outcomes need to change throughout your life. And I think that we need to be focused on what those outcomes are. And so there can be something that is positive about having a reassessment of where you're at, but grease and oil change. I think when you mentioned fear, which has been another thing that has been brought up to me, Georgie, I'm not a chair that can disappear as well. So I don't exist. Everywhere I go for the last 2 weeks, people have spoken to me about their experience with the NDIA. So, and that won't change. That can't change because I can't. I live in Newcastle. I pick my kids up at school. I go to their sports. I travel. I hope to engage in the community. So that means I'm gonna hear those, and I'm gonna always, you know, take that stuff on board. It's the fear reduction will hopefully be another another outcome of the rebuilding of trust.
Speaking of fear, is there anything that you're afraid of coming into this?
You know what? I haven't really spoken about this a lot, but I have anxious for sure. Fear, absolutely. I first started racing when I was 18 years old in front of 118,000 people, and I was terrified. I was thrown up in a bin, scared, really scared. And I spent a lot of years learning how to manage my anxieties, and I managed them really effectively. And part of managing those anxieties is the process that I spoke about earlier on, where I take the time to go through things, and I'm very much a planner, and I try and ensure that what I'm doing and what I'm heading into, I can do good at, and it meets the values that I do hold. There is a part of me that was extraordinarily scared about this role, but over this period of time, speaking to the community, I've been able to get through those anxieties because each conversation I have helps me think that maybe I can do this role, and maybe at this point in time I'm the right person for this role. There's a lot of, my life is about managing lots and lots of fears.
Yeah, totally. And I really appreciate your honesty about that. Can I be honest with you about, seeing that you've been so open with me, I'll tell you a little secret. Go back 12, 15 years ago, whenever I'd see you on the TV, I'd be like, oh no. Can't turn it down. Oh, change the channel. Yeah, for a lot of us, like who, you know, aren't elite sports people, we do get a little bit angsty about the fact that, you know, in this country, for a disabled person to, you know, get recognised, they need to run really fast or hit a ball really well. You know, just look at, you know, the fact that we have a society that idolizes sports people, and a lot of us can't play sport, right?
I've recognized that when you work in the advocacy community, and I feel like I have only brushed against the surface of that, but I've recognized that there is a divide. And Stella was very open with it, and we got Stella over to London, and the conversations that I had in the media about Paralympians are very different to the culture that I was brought up in. And I love the culture that Paralympic sport is. You know, that we were born in the backfields of World War II, and one of the people who were our first Paralympians is Uncle Kevin Coombs. And, like, they built the third biggest multi-sport event in the world out of refusing what non-disabled people had told them that they can't do. They just refused to hear it. And they built this thing regardless. And Uncle Kevin in particular, he wasn't able to compete underneath Australian passport, and he refused to stop. He got an honorary British passport because he was an Indigenous man in a wheelchair, and he refused to stop. And he built a team for the next five Paralympic Games, and he allowed the generosity to every Paralympian that's come after him to call him uncle. And that's not, it wasn't just Uncle Kevin, it's Elizabeth Edmondson, it was Frank Ponter, it was, you know, Terry Giddey, to Errol Hyde, I know that because we are a nation that is consumed by sport, that this was bombarded down people with disabilities kind of eyes, and but inside it was a proud movement of incredibly brave, amazing pioneers that I got to kind of live with, and I make, they are my heroes. I bloody love them. But right now we have incredible, alongside that movement of Paralympians, there has been a disability rights movement that hasn't got the spotlight that it deserves. But we now have people like Rhonda Galbally, Carly Finley, Dinesh Balapana, George Steele John, George Teleporis, Naz Campanella on the ABC. You know, we are getting to the point in community where we have built this incredible Paralympic mechanism that challenges misconceptions around disability. They don't talk about overcoming their disability. They are beautiful, complex people with disability who have found a medium that they love. Sidetracked, George.
No, but yeah, Kate, like, you know, I remember that year or two ago, I didn't know you. You sent me a message on Twitter and you said, you know, if there's anything I can do to amplify your voice, just drop me a line. And I thought, oh, wow, like this is someone who actually believes in community. And, you know, you have a platform that a lot of people don't, but it's obvious to me that you want to use that platform to really, bring the whole community along with you, hey?
But you are my community. Like, the Paralympic world wasn't just those who were, you know, got that incredible, amazing experience of wearing the green and gold. There are 1,000 people with disabilities who'd never wore the green and gold, but they're my family. And like, I don't know, I think that you would find once you get into the community itself that there are a big bunch of people who are extremely thoughtful, like Jared Clifford, Madison De Rosario. Like, they are some of the most thoughtful and eloquent people that I have ever met, and they do have a strong sense of social justice and a strong sense of where we need to be when it comes to disability rights. I just think that the media have had issues telling those stories, and I think Madison spoke about it in Tokyo. You don't have to be a Paralympian to be exceptional. Like, That's a Paralympian saying that. I hope, George, that I do remember shooting you a message, and it was before this role. So
I don't know, it was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago, and I don't know. I just think that I just think that the Paralympic movement is a lot more complex than what an. To be honest, what a non-disabled media has spoken about it for a generation. Now, that's going to change because there are disabled voices in the media like Naz Campanella. I'm trying to think of the young fella from SBS as well as the, you know, but those stories will change now because I think we will be able to have our own voice within it.
And last words for the community that's listening to us.
I'm excited about this journey, and I'm excited to meet the people within the organisation, and I'm excited about also having a more complex conversation publicly about what the NDIA and the NDIS is. That a lot of the times over the last, you know, over the last 3 years, we've only seen a conversation about the NDIS being this single line item in a budget, where it is so much more than that. It is a facilitator of disability rights. Disability rights are human rights. It has a productivity gain within the community. There is so much more to this scheme than a single line item that is a headline of a newspaper. And I'm excited about having that conversation with community as well.
I'm so excited to have you, Kat, as our chair of the NDIS. I'm really looking forward to lots more conversations and just seeing the journey that you're about to go on and the journey that the whole community is about to go on with you as our leader.
Our leader. Oh, my God. Yes.
Chairman Kat Fanley, thank you for joining me.
Anytime, George. Thanks, mate.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Reasonable and Necessary. Thanks for joining us, and thank you also to our partner for this episode, the National Disability Insurance Agency. To be notified of future episodes, please don't forget to hit the subscribe button and the notification bell. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.